So I hope you enjoyed the screening yesterday, although I hope that my synopsis gave you an idea of what the film is about. I guess there were also a lot of things to see, not just to listen to, apart from music, which is international by its very nature. And I will deal closely and more in detail with the film. Let me start today with one subject which one can develop out of this films, of this film, the Berlin Ecke Schönhauser. I will today zoom in particular on one aspect of DIFA film history, which on the long run has become typical for its style and approach. The depiction of everyday life in the GDR, what was called the so-called Alltagsfilm, which on the long run was one of its main, so to speak, preoccupation. And one can trace back this, so to speak, documentary style in feature films to this beginning in the year 1955-56 with, among others, the movie we saw yesterday. The main reference in terms of historical research and film history to this trend, to this particularity of the East German cinema, is Joshua Feinstein's book The Triumph of the Ordinary, Depictions of Daily Life in East German Cinema, 1949 to 1989, a very nice PhD work of an American colleague. And I recommend to read you, also in view that I was told to assign readings for the final exam, the chapter 2 of this nice book, which is devoted to the movie you saw yesterday, Berlin Ecke Schönhauser, and the subtitle or the title of the chapter is The Discovery of the Ordinary, Berlin Ecke Schönhauser and the 20th Congress of the CPSU, of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Although the topic of describing the everyday life of ordinary citizens, of ordinary GDR citizens, became the dominant style, so to speak, only for the decades of the 70s and the 80s. It originated in this constellation in the middle of the 50s. In particular, also, if one looks at who were the initiators or the first directors and writers who followed this new approach, new in the context of GDR film history. There one has to look at the younger generation at this time. One particular figure stands out, or in the beginning it was actually a team of two people standing out, Gerhard Klein, the director, and Wolfgang Kohlhase, the scriptwriter. And they were, so to speak, in the canon of DEFA films, they are very well known for their series of so-called Berlin Filme. One has to say they both originated from Berlin, both from, let's say, lower class, lower middle class, working class backgrounds. Both were kind of given the chance, and this was typical for the 50s in the GDR, they were given the chance to make a upward social climb, so to speak, becoming artists, and they were given their chance in the new state socialist film industry. This was typical for this period that young people of working class background could enter into positions in East Germany, which traditionally were not typical, so to speak, career station stops for working class people. And so from very early on in the 50s, they collaborated, formed a team of director and scriptwriter, and Alarm im Zirkus, Berliner Romanze, Berlin Ecke Schönhauser, and then a sort of latecomer, Berlin um die Ecke. Typically, they focused, Alarm im Zirkus was a kind of crime story for kids, for not even youth, rather for the 10 years old than the 15 years old. It took place also in divided Berlin. Was about a circus whose horses were stolen and smuggled into the West, and kids would help find out who has stolen the horses. And it was also very close to the regular, so to speak, popular life in Berlin, but it was still rather innocuous, so to speak, harmless story, as well as Berliner Romanze, which is a typical East-West love story, a West Berlin girl falling in love with an East Berlin guy, and in the end, from the perspective of the East, taking the right decision, that is, move into the East. This was in 55. And then the third movie of this series in the 50s was Berlin Ecke Schönhauser, which you saw yesterday, and which also aroused the most controversy, which I will tell you later. It is important to know that then later on, in 1965, they produced yet another sequel, so to speak, of their Berlin films, besides doing other work together, but which was not focused on Berlin in particular, which was, however, not even premiered and completed for political reasons, but was banned before completion, so it could only be shown in as late as 1987. Just to finish the note in particular on Wolfgang Kohlhase. Wolfgang Kohlhase, the writer of these films, is one of the most successful and most influential DEFA artists in general, and also one of those who, one of those who got on in a very productive way after 1989, which was not the routine with all DEFA artists, so to speak. You see a long oeuvre. He's now in his late 70s and always writing scripts. The most last one, which I saw, there were, I saw also a poster here in the Czech Republic, Whiskey mit Vodka. I don't know what this is, a whiskey with vodka. It's a comedy with a film director, very famous film director now in Germany, Andreas Dresen, from the youngest generation of DEFA directors. He's in his mid-30s, something like that. There are other very important films among this list. If you look through the directors he worked with, there's everyone who was really important. Konrad Wolf, about whom I will speak later, with Konrad Wolf in 90, he co-authored, he co-authored in 1968 with Konrad Wolf, Ich war 19, which is a very important film about the end of the war, 1945, in the surroundings, in the region around Berlin. He produced with Kurt Metzig, whom I mentioned yesterday, the director of this big monumental Thälmann film, the first science fiction film in 1959, Der Schweigende Stern, The Silent Star, after a novel from Stanislaw Lem. And so one could mention a lot of other films after 1989, one most notably a very interesting film in 2000, Die Stille nach dem Schuss, The Silence After the Shot, which is a very interesting movie on the fact that West German terrorists of the Red Army faction of the RAF hided in the GDR during before 1989 and after 89 were kind of rediscovered, and putting this into a drama together with the very well-known Volker Schlöndorff was also one of the best works Kohlhase continued to do, apart from other typical Berlin films such as 2005 Sommer Form by Kong, the summer, spending the summer on the balcony, basically, a kind of Berlin small people story. This just as a note on Wolfgang Kohlhase, that this name should kind of stick in your mind as still one of the most creative DEFA artists today. Now back to Feinstein's work and his perspective. Why does he call his book The Triumph of the Ordinary? This, of course, entails the notion that this orientation of filmmakers, both in style and in content, had to make its way against severe resistance by the political leadership in the GDR. You can say that in the 50s and the 60s, the film artists and the party were always fighting about the proper way to depict concrete life in the GDR, and only in the 70s and 80s some leeway was given to the film artists to, so to speak, approach the GDR reality in a more realistic and less idealistic way. This has to do with the, so to speak, political and ideological changes in on behalf of the party itself. One can say, very roughly speaking, that's a kind of differentiation which is very common in the historiography on the GDR, that up to until the end of the 60s the party still maintained its utopian style and thrust to complete socialism within a relatively short amount of time. I already told you that also in the 60s in the GDR you saw attempts to reform socialism in order to make it work better than it worked. With a difference to the Czechoslovak case, that they would not get go as far as to reform also the political system and to permit basic freedom of expression and other citizen rights. There, the communist leaders around Walter Ulbricht would shy back from. But in terms of economic reform, they were very much communicating also with their Czechoslovak counterparts. This thrust, this idea to reform socialism, to make it better, was kind of lost both due to 68, as in Czechoslovakia itself, and also both to, so to speak, a option to safeguard what has been reached so far and to get into stable relations, in particular with West Germany and the Western world, in the context of détente. And one speaks in this context of a loss of the utopian moment. And it was this was a time when the term real existing socialism came up. Real existing socialism meaning, well, it's just the socialism we have. There is no other one for the moment. Be content with that one. And real, the utopian version of socialism, where there are no shortages anymore, and where socialist countries are the most modern in the world, well, this will take just another a couple of generations or so. So this notion of real socialism, real existing socialism, made some peace with the things as they existed, and this gave, of course, some more leeway also for film artists to present everyday life as it was perceived by the majority of the citizens. However, during the time the film you saw yesterday was made and shown to the public, the party still maintained its claim to realize the socialist utopia within a short time, that is, within a decade or so. Each piece of art, including film, had to support this perspective and thereby instill an optimistic belief in the audience that such a thing would be possible, socialism within, let's say, 10 years or within the lifespan of the people watching the film, and that every good-hearted individual should be part of this process of constructing socialism, if he only made the right choices. Berlin Ecke Schönhauser is a film which was then criticized by party officials for showing only the problematic aspects, namely youth who have trouble with authorities and barely the good ones, the good young people. To understand why this book could become a contested issue and to why this was so heated, gave occasion to such a heated debate between filmmakers and the party, I will first give some information about the salient significance of this main topic of the film, youth and authority, in the mid-50s, when the first wave of rock and roll culture reached Europe. And then I will deal with the specific artistic means which the filmmakers Gerhard Klein and Wolfgang Kohlhase choose to in order to treat the subject. And then I will have a short outlook on how the topic of rebellious youth was treated later on in the GDR, and also point to the fact that this relation between the youth and the regime itself was always a salient and a very sore point for the GDR regime in general. You can say the GDR failed most strongly with its youth, with its young generation. Once they grew up, they became more adaptive and silent and complacent, but the young people always were a problem. The young, in particular, in the age before they entered university, to be precise, during high school. this could also, because I'm now going into more details about the film, be an opportunity that you ask me questions about the film, perhaps things you didn't completely get, or some questions which you might ask about the film as you saw it yesterday. So, because I will make allusion to parts of the film, and maybe you did not get one or the other details right, or please interrupt me if you have questions in that direction. Any further question asked or so? Okay, just make yourself visible so that I can take such questions in order to answer them right away. As you have seen, it's a film about a group of youth getting into conflict with the authority in place, represented mainly by the police, and particularly by this elder police officer who is in the very beginning of the film starting to write down the report of the main male figure, Dieter. And this writing down, as you have seen, is the frame of the whole story. The actual drama then is the story Dieter tells the policeman. The conflict between the youth and the authority is clearly shown as a generational conflict. As a group, the teenagers show little respect for the older generations. They behave in a distinctive, often provocative way in the street public, but also on the police station and at other occasions. And they do this also, among other things, by expressing their predilection, their taste for rock and roll music, and a certain cool attitude. You certainly have seen that this Dieter is always moving and behaving sort of like as if he tries to copy either James Dean or Marlon Brando or some other sort of model of idol, which he might have seen in a movie theater in West Berlin. Then on more single occasions and kind of accidentally, these youth are getting into more serious trouble. The world of Western culture, of Western movies, the world of Western luxury is luring one of these young guys into even criminal activities, into this business of smuggling passports. The other, the one who is called Kohle, is addicted to so-called Westfilme, Western films, and thereby losing any sense for reality. He's a sort of small little dreamer. And Dieter, his best friend, follows him out of solidarity after they thought they would have killed Karl Heinz by throwing the stone in this house on the ceiling. But in the end, you can say this is how the story gets closes. In the end, Dieter's sense of social responsibility, of belonging, of knowing where which side he has to opt for after he has spent several days in this refugee house in West Berlin. He goes back. He kind of rejects the Western decadence and offers and gets back to his girlfriend and assumes responsibility. This is mainly the closing message, that he will assume his responsibility for his girlfriend and for his place in society. On the whole, this is by and in itself, although there are dramatic episodes, but on the whole it's a rather undramatic and one could even say banal story. However, the subject was not banal at the time. The years 1955 and 1956 had seen the first youth riots in Germany after 1945. And these youth riots, which took place both in West Germany and big cities, but also in several East German cities, and more or less at the same time, around 55, 56 and 57, these youth riots were interconnected with a wide reception of the new commercially distributed youth culture coming from the United States. I mentioned already James Dean, Marlon Brando, Bill Haley. It is important to know that this new youth culture, which established itself in the United States, was basically created by the public spaces in movie theaters, the concert hall, and the dance floor. This was, so to speak, the public places where these youth constituted themselves, apart from standing at corners in the street. Rock and roll music had been around in the US approximately in its beginning, since 1953. And in the US, it draws a substantial part of its subversiveness from the fact that class and gender boundaries were kind of blurred and not any longer clear as before. White kids would dance to black music performed by white and black musicians, and there was a new way of dancing which transgressed conventional, so to speak, gender roles. The girls dancing much more actively than before, and in a way where you could not tell apart whether the girl or the boy would lead while dancing. This was something which was troubling adult generations a lot. It was identified as tearing down essential aspects of social order. And it is very interesting to note that this insecurity, this panic in view of this new youth culture, was something which was evenly shared both by conservative elites in the West and by the elites, the communist elites in the East. In the beginning, they reacted totally in the same way, practically with the same words, that this is, in Europe, I mean, this is decadent, this is tearing down certain boundaries which are essential for a decent and constructive behavior. It's disrespect for the elder generation, and thereby one should fight against this. And one could say that even some conservatives in the West would point at the harsh measures taken by communist authorities in the East against such rock and rollers, and saying, well, you see, in the East they know how to handle with such guys, we should proceed the same way in the West. Later on, just to complete this short digression, of course, the strategy in dealing with such youth cultures diverged enormously between East and West, because in West you found a kind of adaptive and you can say depoliticizing psychological way to deal with youth rebellion. It was interpreted as a transition phase. Whereas the Eastern communist view on this phenomenon was always preoccupied by the risk that this would estrange youth from the communist state, from communist politics, and is therefore always to be considered as somehow dangerous. In particular, of course, the intermingling between East and West and sharing this kind of culture was most easy to practice in a place like Berlin, where you had the city divided up in two parts and with open communication between them, East and West Berlin. So for East Berlin youth, it wasn't particularly very easy to be always up to date with what the latest movie or the latest hits and music were, and the new dance styles and so on, as long as the Berlin Wall was not yet erected. So this is insofar a very typical description of how Berlin Jews, also in downtown East Berlin, were connected to this new movement. It was only a matter of not even 1 year after Rock Around the Clock, movies like Rock Around the Clock or Blackboard Jungle were distributed in Germany, that German producers considered also to produce a German style, a German version of such a, as it is called, meanwhile, a juvenile delinquency film. That's a genre designation, juvenile delinquency film. You could put Berlin-Ecke Schauenhauser in this category of juvenile delinquency films. The typical model is Rebels Without a Cause, and the White One, and in the state then this was really becoming a kind of cottage industry producing endless juvenile delinquency films, which in majority are utterly bad, of course, and exploitative, never reaching the standards of the first very good films such as Rebels Without a Cause. German producers thought about doing this for the German audience with German actors in order to exploit the wave, of course, and in order also to launch German stars, which would go well with the young audience. And so already in 1956, the first West German, the first West German Halbstarken film, Halbstark was a West German synonym for hooligans or rowdies, was announced and then also produced within a short time. And it featured one of the upcoming young stars later on. He also did some work in Hollywood, Horst Buchholz, very young, beginning, I think 21 or something like that at this time. Taking place also coincidentally in Berlin, but mainly in West Berlin, but also with some intersection, some interference of the Cold War, but not to the point, not comparable as with Berlin-Ecke Schönhauser. Interestingly enough, also the GDR youth were expecting their film on problems of young people. As the filmmakers of Berlin-Ecke Schönhauser, Klein and Kohlhase, learned when they met at youth forums which were organized by the state youth. So they would contact youth, they were interested in whether how these youth were seeing their situation. And so they were told by East Berlin youth and other youth in the GDR that they would also like to have their own, so to speak, Halbstarke film, their own film on rebellious and rock and roll imbued young people. And this, to this extent, Berlin-Ecke Schönhauser was responding to the expectations of a young audience, which in a kind of self-assured way was forming a substantial part of the cinema goers, of course, and which had acquired, however, these standards and these expectations by taking part in this general reception of US popular culture, of US youth culture. But what Klein and Kohlhase did then, out of, so to speak, this opportunity to respond to such a demand, was not a simple replication of, let's say, the West German model of Die Halbstarken, or kind of replicating something like the James Dean films. They did not produce a sort of gloomy, sensationalist film on criminals and their horrors. This is rather the way Die Halbstarken goes. Nor did they copy the kind of funny, more comedy-like films such as Rock Around the Clock, which were another reaction to this rock and roll wave by the movie industry in the US. They rather focused on the living conditions of these youth, their standard, their normal everyday life occupation, in particular on the concrete reasons for the troubles they have with their parents. You will see with each of these main characters in the film, there's always some time devoted to their home situation. The one living only with a mother, the other one living with very authoritarian parents who beat them regularly. The other one, the third one, Karl Heinz, living coming from a bourgeois background with which he is estranged, and the main character having no parents at all but living together with his brother, with his elder brother, who at his dismay is also a policeman. So this is paid quite a lot of attention to. You will also see, and this was rather rare at the time, how the interior of such old houses in downtown Berlin were looking like under poor conditions in 10 years after the end of the war. These were the kind of realities which communist cultural politicians did not like to see too extensively being shown in the public of the new socialist country. The conflicts with authority these youth get into arise from certain circumstances, such as the political division of the city of Berlin, this confrontation with different social and moral standards and world which they shared in by being able to commute between East and West. But what is important in all cases is that these conflicts and these confrontations are not shown as emanating, let's say, from an inherently bad character of these youths themselves. They are just young people trying to orientate themselves in a complex and also morally confused and uncertain world, and by reasserting their own stand, their own position, they run into troubles with elder generations. They try out, so to speak, new opportunities, following attractions which are over there in the West, and then they get into conflict. Putting the, so to speak, ordinary or the unspectacular and the average nature of these young people in the center of the stories and of the screen also constituted, of course, an indirect rejection of the party's line in cultural politics of what was called so-called socialist realism. This is already, so to speak, on a very general level, evident from the first shot, this 360 degree round shot showing the intersection at Schönhauser Straße, which, apart from a hint, so to speak, at a slogan of the leading newspaper of the party Neues Deutschland in the very beginning of this round shot, does not show anything particularly socialist or new, or the new Das Neue, which should have been in the center of a, so to speak, socialist realist film. It just shows the buildings of an old working class district in downtown Berlin as it happened to be at this time. This is put in the center of the story, so to speak, in the beginning. This is a place which will serve as a sort of central stage for the rest of the film. And this is obviously not a stage for socialist heroism, where the erection of the new political and social order can be observed. It's rather a cross point for regular people of all ages and backgrounds pursuing their mundane tasks, which then included in this leads to these collisions and conflicts with youth who still have to find their place in the world. And at the beginning of the film, they choose this section under the underground bridge in order to gather and to reassure or to demonstrate their own identity by improvising this rock and roll dance scene, from which the smashing of the street lantern evolves. And it's out of this, so to speak, opening scene that the sequel of conflicts and tribulations, so to speak, evolve. This the means, the instruments, so to speak, Klein and Kohlhaas choose to put this view on Berlin's society on film were inspired to a large extent by their individual reception of Italian neorealism of the late 40s, in particular the films of De Sica. using wide lenses and grainy footage make the film look a little bit like a documentary. I always had in mind it should look like footages from newsreel rather than the thing you would produce in studio productions. And actually, if you see how the production of the film was made, how it began to be made, there was a lot of documentary work, so to speak, invested in it. Both Klein and Kohlhase spent a lot of time with, first of all, identifying location in old neighborhoods in Berlin. Sometimes they told afterwards they would start with a very vague idea about the next project and first going to the locations and then find out what a story they would tell about. The scriptwriter Kohlhase even went visited the police and was allowed to take a look at files of concrete cases of juvenile delinquency, of procedures and trials, in order to find out how these young people were perceived by the police. And there he came across such a kind of a moderate, let's say, very pedagogical, pedagogically acting police officers who told him about the problems with troubled youth, so to speak. And Klein and Kohlhase also spent a lot of time, of course, with young people themselves in Berlin, East and West, not only in order to learn about their worldviews and about the problems they have, but also in order to recruit lay actors for the movie. The most outstanding example is the female lead actor, which is a amateur, which never made a film career afterwards, whereas the male lead actor and the two other boys are professional actors, which later on would make brilliant careers in DEFA and East Germany. Kohle is still always on German TV screens as a very old police commissioner now in his 80s. I do not know why in TV series police commissioners are always allowed to work until they are 80, but in this case it works out very nicely. But the principle was, of course, to also for smaller roles to engage lay actors to work very closely together with the clientele for whom this film was also designated. The result was a film who did not at all, as I told or already confirmed, to the party visions of how the life of young people should be described and be discussed in the public sphere. And this became all already evident during the final stage of production, when a commission of the Ministry of Culture had to let the film pass. At least somewhere in the film it was said it should be visible that this was taking in place in the GDR at all, where socialism was on the march and where the party of the working class, as it was called, was ruling, was having responsibility. And so Klein and Kohlhase had to insert the scenes with where the functionaries of the youth organization, you might have seen one of the girls running around with this little sticker on her shirt, FDJ, Freie Deutsche Jugend, which was the communist youth organization. You had two scenes in the movie where these functionaries of the youth organization try to convince Dieter, the main male role, to join their ranks, to get more active in the youth organization, and he rejects their offer and says, well, I don't have time, I care only my own business, and let me in peace. So this was sort of, these scenes were kind of a concession of Klein and Kohlhase to the party in order to make the movie public at all, otherwise it would not have passed. If you look closer at these two scenes, they have no consequences, no function for the drama evolving, so it's very obvious that they were just put in from inside in order to get the allowance for the film to be shown. On the other hand, one would be totally mistaken if from these controversies which the film encountered already before being premiered, one would be totally mistaken if one could consider this film to be sort of anti-socialist or against the communist regime. Despite its critical stance towards the preconceived, so to speak, dogma of the party and its dogma of socialist realism, the film's message is more or less pro-socialist, and above all, it's pro-GDR. The West is described as, in the end, a dangerous and treacherous, and this also in a rather stereotyped and exaggerated way, sphere full of dangers. And while the own collective, the people in East Berlin, the so to speak, the social surrounding, the sort of friendships and their own, are kind of given a moral priority. In the end, it is good that Dieter goes back to where he comes from and assumes responsibility there, where the problems he has to fight with originate. It is this priority of the own social background, lower class Berlin, if you want, which corresponded to the ways both Klein and Kohlhaase were socially brought up, which is not meaning that just by this, that they were themselves coming from lower class Berlin, that they were particularly, so to speak, loyal to the party. It would just mean that they would opt for this part of the city and in this situation would send the message to their young audience that they should not run away from the problems, but be active and take responsibility there where problems come from. So one could say this film is making a plea, so to speak, for the GDR and the people in the GDR and eventually also socialism. But it won't delegate, so to speak, the responsibility for socialism and for getting engaged in social responsibility to an omniscient party and its functionary. Rather, it is the sense of the individual which is appealed to. This becomes very evident in the final scene of this film. This ambivalence between a plead for socialism in a very general sense and stressing the individual is also expressed in these somehow enigmatic words of the voiceover comment at the very end of the film. The very end of the film, the police officer sends Dieter, after he has given his account about all these complicated stories and how Kohle has died, and so on, so on. The police officer is typing down his report, and then he says, now you can go home. And Dieter then goes home to see his girlfriend in the courtyard, as in the beginning of the film. And from the voice of the police officer then continues while this is shown how Dieter goes back to his girlfriend as a comment, so to speak, from the off. I quote first in German, then in English. Ich bin schuldig und du bist schuldig. Wo wir nicht sind, sind unsere Feinde. Fang neu an. I am guilty and you are guilty. Where we aren't, our enemies are. Make a new start. The interesting thing is that the term where we aren't, our enemies are, is a typical, so to speak, defensive claim of the Communist Party, saying if we do not occupy a certain place, if we do not take care, then the class enemy will invade and take the souls away of these young people, and so on and so on. This is why one should reject Western culture, and why one should not go to West Berlin, why one should isolate itself from Western influences. But the framing, I am guilty, you are guilty, is putting the emphasis on individual responsibility, that everyone, and not just the authorities, which in this case is the policeman, that everyone is in charge of improving things, and that there should be second chances, that no one can be sorted out. Fang neu an, start a new, make a new beginning. And so also if you address this to a audience of young people, it's a very open sentence. It can be also interpreted in a way around who is the enemy in this case. Perhaps some youth might say the enemies are, just the contrary to the intended meaning, is the party or the wicked world of authorities and so on. So the interesting thing is the orientation on individual responsibility, which cannot be delegated, which cannot be given to some superior dogma, ideology, and wisdom of a party. With this approach to narrate the social reality of their hometown, Klein and Kohlhaas established themselves, so to speak, as a sort of eccentrics in the mainstream of filmmaking in the GDR in their time. They were quite young. Kohlhaas is just only 10 years older than the protagonist of this film. He's 25 at this time. Klein is 10 years older. And they were among the ones standing out in the artist community of the DEFA at this time, trying out new ways of making film, departing from established or breaking with established conventions as they had been inherited by the UFA, by the big film industry tradition of Germany before 45. In their first films, preferring children and young people as their protagonists, they kind of replicated this eccentric positionality in the film world. They rather choose subjects and people who were not at the center stage, so to speak, of the public and of the political world. They showed social relations which were functioning without needing the omnipresence of a party doctrine handed down as the truth of the omniscient. Rather than going into, let's say, a socialist enterprise and showing conflict there, they would kind of sidestep this centrality of production and construction of socialist, going to realms which had up to that point not been in the central focus of the party, which were considered as a little bit ephemeral. And this is also some similarity with the principles of and the strategies of Italian neorealism. They choose subjects where they thought also that in showing them they do not, so to speak, need the permanent dogmatic interference by the party doctrine, and they say place themselves, Kohlhaas and Klein place themselves, so to speak, rather at the fringes of the politics of culture than in the center. It is evident that they would never have produced a Thälmann film, a film on the socialist hero, and so on and so on. That would not have been their approach, their contribution to film at that time. As a short series of films on children and youth, their lifestyles, their conflicts and behavior in divided Berlin, the series of Berlin films by Klein and Kohlhaas were rather exceptional. From hindsight, one might have to ask why, given the restrictive control of the party, they had been possible or could be produced and all. And this brings us to the political context in which this was possible. In February, and this now refers to in particular to Berlin-Ecke Schönhauser, in February 1956, as you might know, the 20th Party Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, with Khrushchev's secret speech on Stalin crimes, has exposed communist crimes and mistakes, as it was said, or errors committed on behalf of Stalin during the 30s and 40s. And this secret speech both circulated unofficially among communists and in the world public in general, both in East and West. So everyone who was interested could know its contest, although officially it had been a secret speech. Additionally, however, it was to be read aloud inside the communist parties on special party meetings, and this also took place, of course, in the GDR. And one has to make oneself clear that from the point of, so to speak, the political morale and the self-assuredness, this speech and reading it aloud in party meetings had a devastating effect on a lot of devoted and believing communists. The fundamental basis of their belief system was shaken to the ground. Everything seemed as if had to be put in question. And this led to an atmosphere and of open and critical debate, and particularly during the whole year of 1956, in which during which the party establishment, also in the GDR, did not find proper means to stem this way of putting into question almost everything which was sacrosanct in the communist world of thinking. And this only began to be reversed then after the demise, the brutal demise of the Hungarian Revolution, which was used as an opportunity also in the GDR to reverse this development of a more open and liberal situation. But the consequences, the immediate consequences of this, so to speak, spring and summer 1956 was that also with regard to the West, there was more liberalization, there was more acceptance of contacts with the West, also of import of films, for instance, relaxation of censorship in general. And it was under this situation that filmmakers were given more leeway to produce their film the way they preferred, to refrain from thorough interference in the production of filmmaking from the early stage on. Ironically, it was this was also an after effect of these two monumental Thälmann films, which I had talked about yesterday, which were extremely representative, fulfilling all the expectations of the political leadership, and which gave credit to the film artists. So after the film artists had shown they can put up such a big monument for the most important communist working class hero, then the establishment would say in 55, 56, well, we will become a little bit more liberal, we will not interfere in every stage of film production. And so this was a situation from which Berlin, Ecke Schönhauser, and some other films were profiting. And it is interestingly in this, so to speak, situation of fermentation that the most important filmmakers of the GDR made their first bigger appearances. Also Konrad Wolf was starting exactly in this time, the director I will speak about in 2 weeks. Same is true for Frank Beyer, also one of the big names in film industry, but one could on go on with a whole generation of, at that time, young people around in their early 30s approximately, or late 20s, Heiner Caro, Ralf Kirsten, Egon Günther. This was, so to speak, the formative period in which the best potential of the East German filmmaking could start in this short period of thaw in the GDR. As I had told, Berlin Ecke Schönhauser went extremely well with the young audience in East Berlin. It was also accepted by the critique as innovative. It was even accepted, which was rarely the case, by West German film critics. But now after, during 57, by the end of 57, the tide had already changed. The climate was going back to a more restrictive and authoritarian policy on behalf of the SED. And this meant also turning back to the more dogmatical cultural politics of socialist realism. In 1958, Berlin Ecke Schönhauser was banned as a film. That means it was not distributed anymore. No cinema could book it. And it was among the most contested and most hotly debated films on a so-called Central Film Conference in July 1958. Central Film Conference meaning the film community meeting the political establishment in cultural and politics. Alexander Abusch, the director of the main department for film within the Ministry of Culture, and at the same time a leading theoretician of the Communist Party, declared with the regard to the proper understanding of realism, and I quote now in order to show you this kind of contrast between socialist realism as a dogma and the understanding of people like Kohlhaas and Klein. I quote from this Communist Party functionary: "Some filmmakers have offered an absurdly exaggerated critique of a number of isolated instances of dogmatic and inflexible aspects of everyday life, and in the process convinced themselves that they have discovered the key to making marvelous films." So he's trying to rewrite people like Klein and Kohlhaas, because Klein and Kohlhaas were defending their stance and their approach to filmmaking in a very kind of self-assured way. They said, well, we are influenced by neorealism and we think one should do films exactly like we do. They were, so to speak, developing a little dogma on their own. Abusch continues, I quote, "It must be clear to filmmakers in the GDR that the aesthetics of the Italian realists, intended as they are to expose the irresolvable antagonisms of capitalist society and encourage the members of that society to rebel against it, are not appropriate for films set in a workers' and peasant state. The use of so-called critical realism cannot but leave us with a pseudo-representation of the new reality we live in." End of quote. So the suitability of the neorealist approaches to support the anti-capitalist and in the end, such the expectation of a communist, of course, to social revolution, this was not denied. This might work well under capitalism, so to speak. What was denied was that it made any sense to transfer such a concept in the situation of socialism where the workers and peasants were already in power. With this verdict, neorealism, or as it was also called in the literature later on, documentary realism as an approach of representing the GDR was more or less banned for another sequel of years. It, however, resurged again and again, and one moment of these resurgence I will speak about in the middle of the 60s will be dealt with the next time. What has to be made clear, however, is that, of course, this adversity, so to speak, to the artist's way of showing or to present problems of youth in the GDR was not only grounded on matters of style alone. It was also, in particular, the theme which Berlin-Ecke Schönhauser touched upon, which was one of the very sore points of the system itself, that is the relation between the youth and the younger generation and the regime in general. And this is why Berlin-Ecke Schönhauser is not only interesting, so to speak, as a film in the sense of art history by its style, its approach to develop a concept of realism. It is also important worthwhile to look at it as a historical source for a certain fundamental problem of the GDR or the communist regime in the GDR, which was never going away. One should ask where from comes this strong reaction against the movie and of Klein and Kohlhaas, and there were reasons behind it which went beyond the purely aesthetical problematic. The communist dictatorship always invested high hopes in the youth of its country. While they were counting with the resistance, or at least the lack of enthusiasm, the communists were counting with the lack of enthusiasm among the adults, which had grown up under Nazism, for instance, they counted on the support of those younger generations which had been raised under the new political circumstances, under socialism, and which would therefore not be spoiled by, so to speak, class enemy influences, by old cultures, so to speak. The actual young people growing up in the GDR, however, again and again disappointed the communist leaders through their lack of enthusiasm there and their oppositional or rebellious attitudes. And as is well known, and this is a general feature for modern societies, east or west, north or south, the age of puberty and adolescence always brings some potential of conflict with it. That's a generic feature of modern societies. And in principle, this was also known to the youth politicians of the communist GDR. Nevertheless, the manifestation of such juvenile self-assertions in public in particular were regarded as politically dangerous from the outset. In the eyes of, for instance, state prosecutors police officers, this behaving, and party functionaries in particular, this behaving like a rowdy or a hooligan, such the official term, always carried an anti-state and thereby anti-socialist element in it. The mere fact of displaying a youth-specific otherness in such a demonstrative and ostentative way was seen as putting into question the very norms of public behavior, of the socialist moral order. And in the eyes of the party, the dangerousness of such a behavior was even proven by the fact that it used styles and aesthetic of Western youth culture. You could say this, such a behavior, such a rebellious, obnoxious behavior could be there independent of whether there are Western cultural influences or not. In this concrete situation of the Cold War, East German, the communist leader thought that this dangerousness of this rowdy behavior is proven by the fact that in order to show their opposition, they borrow from the West. They don't use, so to speak, Eastern style vocabulary or aesthetic forms. No, they borrow from the Western in culture industry. And in consequence, any display of such attributes could, by and in itself, be interpreted as rebellious and politically subversive. And this was what happened then throughout the decades of the GDR. Always, if youth would kind of appropriate a new fashion, a new wave of pop culture in the GDR, the first 2 years, this would be the authorities would react to these as indecent rebellions and to be persecuted, whether it was the long hairs or wearing jeans, or later on when the punks came up with their cutting all hair together, etc., or dyeing the hair. All this was in the first instance repressed as being anti-communist. This problematic, I want to point to an important book, is treated at length and in a classical, one of the, so to speak, pioneering studies in cultural history of post-war Germany, in the book by Uta Peuger, Jazz, Rock and Rebels, Cold War Politics and American Culture in Divided City, one of the, let's say, 10 books in English, which are really have opened up a new field in research in the last 10 years. The party took a harsh course against all such public manifestation of youth culture when it had the feeling that youth were going too far, and that had been also the case in 56 and 57. The police were very, very precise and accurate in registering and taking down every rowdy or hooligan, everyone confessing himself or portraying himself as an adherent of Western youth culture was registered by the police. I have seen these files. You had thousands of youths being in file cards at the police stations on every local level. The most rebellious ones, the one whom one could get for some minor criminal offenses, were sent to work camps for some six-week shock therapy or forced labor, or sent to jail for several months in more severe cases. Since one has to keep in mind, since the factors which motivate youth to behave the way they do in such situation, namely a certain sense of opposition and self-manifestation towards the adult world, and since also the mean to express this stance, namely styles and pattern from Western culture, continue to be offered to them, this sort of conflict between youth cultures and the regime stayed with the GDR until its very end. On a very general level, one can say to win over the younger generation for the cause of socialism was one of the fields in which the Communist Party leadership failed in the most blatant and obvious way. They left always behind, so to speak, decade by decade, a generation of grown-ups who had been frustrated by conflicts with the communist socialist authorities during their puberty, and who then, when growing up and going into their founding families, etc., etc., would retreat from public life as much as they could, because they knew it's difficult to deal with authorities, with communist authorities. And this experience of frustration is a central feature for social life in the GDR, which explains also why GDR citizens did not bother to give up the state altogether when they had the first opportunity to do so 20 years ago. This was one of the reasons, because this was a very widespread experience, apart from the consideration that joining West Germany would be a good thing for material and other reasons. Of course, nevertheless, and this is my final point now, cultural politicians try to cope with the fact of this strong influence of Western youth culture. At some point, they had to accept and to face the fact that this will not be, they will not be able to do away with it altogether. So they followed to some extent the way which had been already pointed by Kohlhaase and Klein, namely produce own variants of youth culture to offer to the GDR youth, which politically would be more or less correct, but they did not follow, so to speak, the concept and the approach and the attitude of Kohlhaase and Klein in the way I described, taking the perspective of the youth and stressing their individual responsibility. Rather, there were several sort of juvenile delinquency film or teenager pictures which were produced by DEFA in order to kind of lure into the system to speak to the young generation from a GDR politically correct point of view. And partially this could also work. I will give you two examples from later film history in the GDR. But it functions with sometimes with very paradoxical effects. This is a film from 1962, the Glatzkopfbande, the gang of bald heads, which is showing or describing a gang of youths for who for just for a bet, for a joke, had shaved their heads. So the early precursors of skinheads. And they go through the countryside, in particular at the Baltic coast in the summertime, and provoke adults, making a lot of havoc. And in the end, they are all put into jail. I don't want to go into the details of this. The main act, and there is always, and so far it's kind of borrowing from Western culture, the main act poses as a former legendary who is a fan of Yul Brynner. And Yul Brynner was also evidently another of these despised imperialist idols in international film industry. And so it's following a conversation about this idol Yul Brynner that this gang of five people, of five boys, decide to shave their heads. And although initially it was thought as a typical juvenile delinquency film with a moral message that taking the wrong choice would bring you into jail and you should not do this and see how bad they got, of course it provoked the reverse reaction, young people shaving their heads and imitating the bad guys instead of sticking to the good guys. So also this film had to be taken out of distribution for pedagogical reason. It went well because it's a nice crime story, but the message was not was kind of spoiled by the way in which the young people appropriated the film. But there you can see very clearly this was a way to produce a socialist, politically correct juvenile delinquency film. And then a totally different strategy was followed in this film, a musical. You could say, how can socialist realism and musical get together? Because nothing is as unrealistic as people in a film story from one time to another singing into the camera and dancing up and down the places and so on. That's what they do, these young people, throughout the film. There's also some kind of transgression and criminal behavior part of it, but on the whole, it's a very funny summer film, typical youth on vacation film, and imitating a lot of West Side Story elements in dancing, choreographed jazz dancing, with a couple of very famous songs, rock and roll stars, the main act in the middle, Frank Schöbel, and the woman on his left side, his wife at that time, Chris Dirk. They were kind of the idols of young people in the GDR, so the GDR leadership also consciously tried to exploit this in order to offer a real good movie for the young. So what is characteristic here, and that's what the last point I want to share with you, is that this strategy of doing youth films, using genres which were established in international film culture in the own context, was becoming more and more a strategy in East German filmmaking during, in particular during the, it began in the 60s, but played out much more in the 70s and 80s. In cultural studies, one also speak of a domestication of these genres, in the sense not only that they were kind of tamed like a wild animal, that they are not so dangerous anymore when you do them at home and keep them inside your own premises, but also in the way of making them, so to speak, part of the own culture. To some part, this was successful. For instance, Heißer Sommer was a very popular film and still is among the nostalgic films which sells very well in Germany. Ironically, also in America, young people like it very much. I do not know why exactly. It has some flavor of German otherness which appeals to something. I don't know why. On the long run, however, this strategy backfired. Not only in the way in which this film before, the Glatzkopfbande, backfired, where the youth just interpreted the message the completely wrong way by identifying themselves with the bad guys instead with the good guys. It backfired for still for another reason. GDR audiences, whether young or old, would receive such offers by the cultural industry of their own country and their own state as a mere reaffirmation of the original cultural standards and patterns from which they were derived, that is, from Western, so to speak, imperialist, affluent culture. There was no way to circumvent the notion that, in the end, it was the West who provided these new ideas, these new genre formulas and patterns, from where the new fashions and the generation of new generation of youth cultures emerged. So it was always there, the notion that this is something more or less taken over and adapted. And as much as the young GDR would accept the domestic productions on offer so far as they were offered to them, they nevertheless knew that the original came from somewhere else. And it was this knowledge which, however, on the long run, had a subverting effect on the recognition of the socialist state and regime and of the culture the socialist regime could offer. It was never, so to speak, strong enough to produce an authentic identity on its own. It has only always, in order to produce something popular, in the end borrow some formulas from somewhere else. This buy-in in itself is not untypical also, let's say, for states in the Western cultures, in West Germany, in France or whatsoever. U.S. American influence is strong in all of these places. But the difference is that the claims the states make by producing culture are not so high. In East Germany, the regime would always claim, this is our culture, it's specific, it's socialist, it's the best thing you can have in the world. And if at closer looks, it comes out that it is derived more or less, if you take such a movie from formula which come from somewhere else, and which in the original are much better. Perhaps some of the youngsters would look at West Side Story and found out that it's a bad copy of West Side Story, so they would prefer the original, then this, of course, undermines the legitimacy and the claims of the powers in place in East Germany. And this is why one of the reasons why the cultural politics of the GDR, in particular in the realm of popular culture, was always very precarious, while always on the brink of failing. It was accepted as a way for East Germans to express themselves. They would accept their idols, but they would always see the limits. And this was one of the reasons why the GDR, as a, so to speak, also cultural system, the culture of its own, had a limited life. This stayed with this communist dictatorship until the end, and it communist cultural policy could never solve this dilemma that they had to borrow from the West in order to offer attractive entertainment, which was nevertheless then again re-identified as something coming from somewhere else, as not authentic, so to speak, German communism or German socialism. Okay, this is it for today. Just a brief outlook for the next week, in 2 weeks. I will move into the 60s. The 60s are peculiar in East German film history for one particular event, 1965. At the end of the year, a meeting of the Central Committee, plenum of the Central Committee, practically banned the whole production of all feature films produced in that year, 12 films, a lot of which were very critical and subversive, and which now had to be put back in the shelves, and most of them were only premiered then actually in 1989-1990. The context of this will film political caesura will be combined with a closer look at the oeuvre of Konrad Wolf and his seminal movie The Divided Sky, Der geteilte Himmel. The theme of this movie will not only bring us back to the problematic of divided Germany after the construction of the wall, which is a different situation than before, and the question of how this divided Germany, the duality of Germany, is tied up with the question of gender, of the roles of males and females in the German Democratic Republic. Thank you very much.